battled, along with many, 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 many people, for 10 years to bring some common sense to the Department of Fish and Game in the management of our moose population, only to lose and lose and continue to lose. Come up to 2 years ago, Senator Huber and I on the House side and Senator Huber in the Senate, thought that we had a piece of legislation that would finally protect the cow moose from that hungry bunch of people that I'm going to call the gross mismanagers of our moose herd in Alaska, the Department of Fish and Game. And I don't know how much stronger that I can say my feelings than that. I thought we had a piece of legislation, and every member of the House and the Senate thought so too, that we finally had reached at some kind of a conclusion where we could bring some honesty to those people, but we failed. We passed a piece of legislation, wrote everything that the Fish and Game wanted into the bill. The governor's office promised John Huber in several different conversations that if we would enact this piece of legislation, they would not shoot any more cow moose. If we would enact a piece of legislation that would allow the local advisory boards to recommend to that department before they opened a season. They deliberately deceived us. And I don't know how much stronger that I can make my language than that. Whether they did it under the sanction of the governor, whether they did it under the sanction of the commissioner, I don't know. But they deceived us deliberately and with intent. And that's, I hope that I'm speaking for the record here. It cost one of our legislators $2,000 to bring a lawsuit against the Department of Fish and Game to stop them from violating the law. Now, it's a pretty sad situation when we have a department that deliberately does those kind of things. There is no way in my mind that the Department of Fish and Game will listen to us in any way unless we write specific pieces of legislation directing them to do something. Now, like I said, I've been at this for 10 years, not only as a legislator, but as a lobbyist, trying to get some honesty out of these people, and we've been deceived just time and time again. And that's the reason that I introduced House Bill 20, is to stop taking cow moose. They promised us faithfully last year, sitting right here where I'm sitting. The commissioner sat right here and told us right at this table that if we enacted this piece of legislation, they would listen to us now, that our herds were getting down, they were being deteriorated. And this was one of the things they admitted they'd made a mistake by taking cow moose. Sit right here where I'm sitting. And went right out and broke the law, broke their word, the faith with the legislature and everything else. And that's the reason I introduced this piece of legislation. It's the only thing that they understand. They sit here at the head of this table and tell us that don't take the authority away from us. I'm really concerned of whether or not in the management there's serious doubt, Mr. Chairman, in my mind, whether the Department of Game, Fish and Game, is sitting here at this table telling us that they're trying to protect a resource, but where I think that the only thing that they're trying to protect is their bulging bureaucracy, their fancy studies, and all of the things that they do. I have serious doubt when they sit here and tell us the things that they do, that they're really trying to protect the resource, because this is one of them that they're directly responsible for destroying. House Bill number 20 is a damn simple piece of legislation that finally gets at the truth. The taking of antlerless moose prohibited. The taking of antlerless moose at any time in any game management unit or subunit is prohibited. And that's the only language that these people understand. I've had them tell me many times that, Swanson, you don't have any business telling us what to do. We know how to do it. But by the same token, they won't tell us what happened to our 40,000 moose. They say, oh, that they happened this and somebody ran over them and that the wolves are eating them and everything else. And they've got every kind of a Joe McGee excuse in the world. They are directly responsible doing to us what they've done. And I'm speaking for a lot of people out in my district. I'm speaking for at least 10,000 people that have corresponded with us over the last 8 years, trying to bring some honesty to the Department of Fish and Game. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any questions?
Mr. Bennett.
Representative Swanson, to your knowledge, is there anything bad about letting the cow moose run out of a normal life cycle and becoming barren and finally die of old age? Is there anything wrong with that?
Nothing wrong with my book.
I just was curious because I've heard so many people say, oh, well, they're old and they're barren.
It's a sad thing. It's a sad thing. I've had every, maybe 8 or 10 years ago, some of the big game guides were still doing a meat hunting program. But now they even realize, and they have realized for a number of years, that they must stop taking the cow moose. They absolutely have got to stop, or there's going to be absolutely no herd at all, because you can't kill the cows off and expect them to reproduce. Game guide after game guide has contacted me and has flown me around the country and say, my God, Red, you got to stop those people from doing it. Do something. Well, I tried to do it in the wolf control, and I didn't do it there. But my God, I hope you pass this piece of legislation. This doesn't have any sneaky places where they can give us an end run like they did last year. In 12 or 14 areas, last year they opened the cow season. I've had people come to me from the rural parts of Alaska and say, my God, Red, we got to have, you can't do this because we take the cow. And I say, well, if you're going to take the cow, what are you going to take a yearling 2 years from now? It's gone, it's not there. And many of them, just many, in fact, it was the native people themselves. In 1971, that out of the area between Aniak and Ruby, Holikachuk, and in that area there, where the people were coming in and taking the cow moose, and they asked me to stop it. And it was from native villages that I first started this battle. I realize that, I guess I'm in a position, this is a losing battle, but I have to speak for the people in my district and a lot of people all over this state.
Any other questions? Hearing none.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Rose, you wish to testify?
That's the truth this time, huh?
I'll try.
The Department of Fish and Game opposes House Bill 20. The program effects of the bill are the bill would place an additional drain on alternate food species in rural areas, caribou, sheep, and goats. Further, it would prohibit presently legal local option antlerless moose hunts, and it would prohibit moose management programs designated to maintain moose populations in optimum balance with available range. Comments. The enactment of this bill prohibiting the taking of antlerless moose at any time in any game management unit would appear to violate Article 8, Section 4 of the State Constitution, which requires that resources belonging to the state shall be utilized, developed, and maintained on the sustained yield principle, subject to preferences among beneficial uses. A continuous closure on a species such as moose could hardly qualify as sustained yield of beneficial uses. At present, the authority for establishing antlerless moose seasons is vested with the Board of Fish and Game, and they are limited by a complex system which requires that the department recommend such a season and that the advisory committees for a game management unit or a subunit favorably recommend on the department's proposal. The present system provides an in-depth review of such proposals by the public and the board. There are relatively few antlerless moose seasons in the state of Alaska at this time, and all of them have the support of the appropriate advisory committees, if such exist. The proposals that will be before the Board of Game at the next meeting, March 1977, will all have been favorably considered by the appropriate advisory committees. Imposition of this bill would seriously detract from a progressive systems management regime.
Mr. Rouse.
Mr. Chairman, of course, that is our position. We are in opposition, and those are the basic comments. I'd be pleased to answer any questions or attempt to answer them if the chair or members of the committee have them.
Right.
How many seasons we have?
Mr. Chairman, I can't answer precisely. There are relatively few, most of them in the bush. We had one Game Management Unit 6, Cordova, where we've had one since about 1961. Unit 16, parts of 19 and 21 and 22. That's five total. There may have been some in 25, but I'd have to check that. Basically, they're in the rural areas with the exception of 16 and Game Management Unit 6.
You had one in 16?
Yes, we did. We also had one in Unit 9.
My name is Jim. Were all those approved by the advisory committee?
They were all approved by the advisory committees as provided for under the existing law, with the exception of Unit 16, which at that time had no advisory committee. And it was determined based upon our inquiry to the Department of Law that in such a case that, in effect, a hiatus could not exist and the board could act in the absence of an advisory committee. Since that time, there has been advisory committees formed within that unit.
Any idea how many adverse moves were taken out of Unit 16?
Mr. Chairman, the final tally on the harvest has not been computed. I could provide that to the committee shortly, however.
No idea?
In 16A, it was under 50. In 16B, I don't have a good fix on it. 16A is the easterly portion of Unit 16, and 16B is the bulk of the unit, and I don't have a fix on the 16B figure right now.
Mr. Bennett?
Isn't it true during an antlerless moose season that oftentimes young calves are killed?
Mr. Chairman, under the definition of antlerless, calves are considered antlerless moose and are legal in any antlerless season that has been held in this state since statehood.
Is it corrected in, say, the last 3 years that 20A and 20C have, in fact, had antlerless hunts? I think you might have heard this
one. It may be. I'd have to check it, Mr. Chairman. I don't have all the regulations in mind.
Mr. Jurgen.
Is the prime reason for your having an antlerless moose season in, say, Unit 16, was it to maintain proper balance between bulls and cows?
Mr. Chairman, in all of them at the present time that I'm familiar with, and I think I'm familiar with most of them, has to do with populations that are at or exceeding our estimation of the carrying capacity of the range. And properly handled at a low enough volume, it will not, in effect, affect the upper limits or lower limits of the population. You should be able to stabilize the population. Probably the best example of that has been in Game Management Unit 6 at Cordova, where we've had them now going on some 15 years, and always at the request of the local people. They are requesting one again for next year. Handled with a finely tuned management program, they work very well. There have been cases in the past where the harvests were excessive. There's no question about it. We're gone to a permit system in practically all of those units, with exception of 22 where we hold these, and to gain better control. In Game Management Unit 22, which is the Seward Peninsula, we have a rapidly expanding moose population. And it's primarily a willow range there, and we would like to allow the local residents to use it, and have done so. The point of the previous legislation, as I perceived it at least, was that we were not to have any antlerless moose seasons in any area unless the people actually using the area approved of it before it ever went to the Board of Fish and Game. And we followed that policy, with the exception of Unit 16, of which there was no local advisory committee at that time.
then all the hunts that you had were just based on moose population, nothing to do with the ratio of cows and goats?
Generally speaking, we wouldn't take cows just to balance off the moose population. In other words, in some areas where we've had intensive hunting of bulls, and the sex ratio will get to, for example, 10 bulls per 100 cows, it wouldn't, in my view, be the best way to adjust that by then taking a large number of cows unless you had other reasons, namely range conditions. You probably should at that point back off from taking bulls if you're having problems with reproduction and this sort of thing. It could be used that way, but I don't think it's the best use of it. You should be looking at range conditions.
How do you determine range conditions? How much of a moose population in a certain area can support?
The most commonly used method is looking at survival of calves themselves and condition of the females. Depending upon the range, there's some ranges we obviously don't have intensive work. Some of them in South Central, we've done a great deal of work using everything from the condition of the animal as measured by various blood parameters, such as the we use in the hospital if you go in and do an SMA. Others, merely on incidence of pregnancy and subsequent survival of those calves. The animal is generally a rather sensitive indicator of its nutrition. And if they're born in normal numbers and aren't surviving through to be yearlings, but say were present in November but all died before spring, you've got a very strong indication you've got a range or nutritional problem. If they're not there in the fall, the chances are you've got a different kind of a problem. It's probably predation. You're born in June, gone by November. You better start looking for your four-footed friends or some other factors. Probably not nutrition in that case. Another system we have used, of course, is looking at the range itself. That's very costly when projected on a statewide basis. There's just too many hundreds of thousands of square miles to lay out transects throughout the state of Alaska. So we generally have been working with the animal itself, looking primarily at the survival of calves, at the cows to see that they are pregnant, and at the condition of the cows in late winter. Are they carrying any fat reserves? Are they actually starving to death? This sort of thing, such as happened in Unit 16 in 1970-71 when we lost literally thousands of them during a tough winter.
Have you ever thought of joining anything to improve the range conditions, planning or taking that big masher they got and driving it across the country a little bit so that
the willows can come up? Mr. Chairman, on several occasions in the past, we did request funds for that purpose, particularly in the Matanuska Valley and for in parts of the Tananaw Valley. We haven't been successful in obtaining funds for that at this time. However, on the Kenai Moose Range, there's been some, I believe, in excess of 20,000 acres now that have been manipulated with these very large crushing devices, which kill such things as spruce and birch to a lesser extent that are not the highest quality forage and releasing willow. We have given thought to it, and it's a fairly expensive proposition, but it appears that it may have some favorable benefit cost ratios in key moose ranges.
Mr. Weiss, Mr. Miller.
I'm just wondering, do you have any idea what the percentage of males that are killed that are analysts?
Mr. Chairman, in some situations it has run as high as 40%. We've had a late season on the Alaska Peninsula, again by request of the local residents, and it occurs after the antlers have been shed. And we've had a fairly high percentage, in some cases, of shed antlered bulls taken in December. As I recall, 40% was a recent figure, but it's in that area, maybe almost half at times, but generally in the late seasons.
Mr. Miller.
Yeah, if I read your response to Representative Swanson's statements earlier, your contention is that using last year's legislation, wherever there was a local group, you did follow the wishes of the local group, and there was one instance, 16 I believe it was, where there was no local group. Did you attempt to get any sampling of opinion in that area, and now that there is a local group, do you have any idea what their sentiments are for the next season?
Mr. Chairman, the most controversial area, of course, which did result in the filing of a lawsuit, was 16A. The proposal to open the antlerless season in 16A did not come from the department. It came from the public. And the board decided to consider it, and they did approve it.
In what form did it arrive?
It arrived in the normal sequence of events, requesting an antlerless season in a portion of 16A during the period that we accept proposals from the public. We generally accept proposals for approximately 30 days and then close the proposal period. We publish these, they're commented upon for another 30 days, and then the board acts. The latter period is required by law. The first period is arbitrary. This process was used, and the board did act upon it, and it subsequently turned out that there was a great deal of controversy. This year, with the establishment of a board within that unit, we have had one meeting, which was held last week at Squintna. Some 25 people attended who are year-round residents in Squintna, and none of the advisory committee members showed up. The department was there. The 25 people who were present supported continued antlerless moose seasons in 16B. However, they aren't the official voice because there are no advisory committee members there, so I don't know the feeling of the advisory committee, but I do know the feeling of the 25 residents who were there.
Was there any opposition?
I can't say that it was unanimous. The report that was given to me is that they approved the concept. They were in favor of it.
A couple of questions. First of all, fully realizing the size of our state, hundreds of millions of acres, is your staff large enough to perceive this delicate balance? And further predicated on when bull moose is without antlers and aircraft, which is the main way that any observations are made, December through about April, there's no way of telling the cow from the bull. Feel that your staff is adequate
for
hundreds of thousands of acres to
set
and evaluate whether to shoot them without horns, you know?
Mr. Chairman, I suppose no bureaucrat ever felt their staff was large enough. We recognize that we'd like to have more staff in some outlying areas. And so that we could do some of these counts in a more timely manner. What we have done in some of the outlying areas, such as the Yukon River from Galena down to Holy Cross and on down to Paiute, which is a fairly major moose area, is wait until March, sometimes early April, when most of the moose are concentrated on the river bars, the so-called riparian river bars, and then do these counts. We recognize at that time, in those particular areas, we're not getting a sample of bull versus cow, but what we can get at that time is proportion of yearlings or short yearlings, calves, in the population. And you can get a sizable proportion of the total population concentrated on the rivers at those times. We now, with the advent of more aircraft hunting in the area, which has admittedly become a problem, particularly to the local residents, we are sampling, doing some samples in the fall so we can get a fix on the bull cow rate. We rely fairly heavily upon samples taken in the spring. And I'd be the first to admit that there are areas in 20C, parts of 24, and parts of 25 that I would like to have much more information than we do have.
Mr. Rush, could I ask a question here? Could you tell us on the population on moose today as of 10 years ago throughout the state?
Mr. Chairman, if one were to generalize throughout the state, I would say the moose population has decreased considerably from 10 years ago, if you go back to 1966. Some areas they started decreasing well before that. To be specific, there are a number of areas, such as the Seward Peninsula, that they are exceedingly more abundant, where we had a few hundred moose, there are several thousands now. Hopefully, it's beginning to look like 20A is turning around. We have a good calf crop in 20A for the first time in 5 or 6 years. There are about 42 calves per 100 cows. But the general picture with moose was a high in the late 50s through the mid-60s with gradual decreases, some more dramatic than others. It appears that some of these populations are starting to turn around. Others are not.
on an overall picture, though, what would be the percentage now?
Mr. Chairman, that's a very dangerous game. I've worked with moose, or did work with moose for many years. At one time, we estimated the statewide population at 140,000 to 160,000. I would guess we're thinking more in the neighborhood of now, and this is merely an approximation, probably somewhere between 80 and 110,000, something like that. But I, you know, there's been no such count. Game Management Unit 13, for example, we still can go out into Unit 13 and obtain a sample of, we base our information on a sample of 4,000 animals, which is a substantial group to be working with. That population has gone down, but not to the same extent that some others have, and we've had fairly conservative regulations there in the last 7 or 8 years, and still not responding. We probably have a little bit of a predator problem in 13, in my view.
Thank you. Is there any other questions?
One other question. Is it not correct that the wolf and the grizzly bear are probably the two major predators in the moose?
Mr. Chairman, I would add only one other species to that, and that is the black bear on calving grounds.
Is there any other question, Mr. Rose? Hearing none, what's the wishes of the committee?
Anybody else wants to?
Chairman, I had a general question. I noticed in both the statements that the department handed out, they referred to a possible violation of Article 8, Section 4 of the state constitution. Both these bills. I'd request that your staff contact Legislative Affairs and have them bring down an opinion for this committee for future bills of this nature, so we know if we have a constitutional problem or not. Seems to me that if we're going to be operating under this threat, we should know where we stand, whether we can write this type of legislation or not, constitutionally. I don't think a probable is good enough. I think we should know where we stand.
Is there any other comments in the committee?
Yeah.
Hearing none, so ordered. We'll get some information on it. Bring it up again at a later date. Our next bill is House Bill 62.
Mr. Chairman, were you planning on adjourning to 3? I've been to the meeting at 3. I didn't.
Yeah.
Just to try.
Okay. Jeff Haynes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Haynes. I'm with the Department of Law. I testify on House Bill 62, which is one of the governor's requests. You may remember that 2 years ago, the legislature enacted legislation which split the boards, or the board of then Board of Fish and Game, into separate boards of Fisheries and Game. And in so doing, we perceived, at least, that there were a few more or less housekeeping matters which were overlooked in the enactment of that legislation, which we would like to see corrected. There are four sections in this bill, and each one of them addresses a separate problem resulting from that split board act, and I'll go over them for you real briefly. Section one just addresses itself to the fact that the legislation creating the split board bills neglected to mention the length of terms of the members of the boards of Fisheries and Game, and we're suggesting that it be 4 years, which was what it was for the Board of Fish and Game. If you don't mind, I'm going to skip section two for a minute because that's the most complicated, and go to three and four because they're relatively easy. Section three has to do with joint board meetings. It is possible that there might be circumstances in which there already have been circumstances in which there are matters which both boards must deal with, and we would like to see that dealt with by the boards directly when that comes up. And we just didn't feel the wording of this joint board meeting section here was quite strong enough. and just advocate strengthening it to indicate that the boards really have a responsibility to address these matters that are a mutual concern. I grant that this language isn't really going to make it all that enforceable, because we're not going to be able to lock them into a room or something and make them decide, but we just felt that this thing ought to be strengthened a little bit more. Section 4 has to do with quorums. There is an ambiguity in here, because it wasn't clear on subjects in which both boards were acting together how many votes you had to have from each board. It just says majority of the members of the boards of fisheries and game. And that raises the question of whether you can have 7 from one board and 1 from the other, or whether you got to have 4 from each board. We brought that up before the boards and asked them to adopt a policy on their own, and they felt, and I think legitimately, that if it is a joint board matter, you ought to have a majority of each board voting in favor of it before it passes. So we're just suggesting that this be done legislatively. Okay, Section 2. Pardon?
I guess I'm a little slow. You are requiring concurrent majorities from each board.
Right, 4 on each board, rather than a 7-1 situation. Yep. Right. And that is the way the boards have been acting for the last year. Okay, Section 2 has to do with advisory committees. We're leaving subsection A alone. That's the way it stands now. We divided it up into 3 sections to make it a little bit more readable. And there's really more than one problem we're trying to address in here. The first one has to do with the requirement in the existing law that recommendations from advisory committees, this is, I'm quoting from the law, shall be forwarded to the appropriate board for their consideration. But if the Board of Fisheries or the Board of Game chooses not to follow the recommendations of the local advisory committee, the appropriate board shall inform the appropriate advisory committee of this action and state the reasons for not following the recommendations. I don't know how many of you have attended board meetings, but you're looking, in the case of either board, at 7 people, you know, who are voting on several, in some instances, more than 200 proposals at a meeting. And if the vote, for example, is 7-0, 4 or against, there may be 7 different reasons as to why they voted that way. And if they have to follow this explicitly, it does put, I think, more of a burden on them procedurally than is really necessary to accomplish the purpose here of informing the advisory committees of what the boards did and why they did it. So we're recommending what I think is really a pretty minor change in this section to say that the boards, if it doesn't follow the recommendation, shall ensure that the formal record of the meeting reflects the reasons for that decision, and the board shall also provide the minutes of the meeting to the advisory committee. This would allow them, in the instance where the discussion of the proposal had adequately reflected what the thinking of the members were, that would be enough rather than for them having to stop and take some formal action on why they did or did not do something. Okay, the other part is subsection C in your bill here, and this has to do with the subject of emergency closures. This has been talked about some before. There was something of a change in the split board bill from the previous law. Previous law more or less said that the commissioner was to delegate authority to advisory committees to make emergency closures, and then that the commissioner could override those closures if he so wished. The way it's set up now, it's really a little bit confusing. It says the commissioner shall delegate authority to advisory committees for emergency closures during established seasons. And then it says the commissioner is empowered to set aside and make null and void only opening of seasons set by advisory committees. Well, they really haven't even authorized an opening, and now they're saying the commissioner can only make null and void the opening of seasons. The big problem here is really a constitutional one. And that is that advisory committees, even though they are established under the law, are essentially made up of private individuals. They're not confirmed by the legislature, and there's really not a great deal of guarantee that they necessarily reflect the public interest in a matter in the way that the legislature would, or that the board does, because the board does have to go through a confirmation proceeding. As a result, courts that have reviewed this kind of a delegation have sort of frowned on it. Because of the fact that there is really no supervision exercised by the government, yet you are giving them the power to adopt what amounts to a state law that carries a criminal penalty that goes with it. So we more or less feel that as this thing is written now, without that kind of supervision from a governmental authority that is, confirmed by the legislature and does represent the public interest, that those closures would probably not be constitutional. So we're recommending that this section be changed so that advisory committee emergency closures must obtain the approval of the appropriate board before they go into effect. And then we're saying also that the the board must adopt regulations indicating what the procedures are for governing emergency closures. They have already done this, as a matter of fact, and we're really in this section reflecting what the board has already done, but we do want to kind of clean it up in the legislation. One other problem which has arisen is the fact that under the existing law, it says they can make closures, but it doesn't say where the closure would be effective. We got, I don't know, 50-some advisory committees in the state. Sometimes you have 6 or 7 in one game management unit, so you have the possibility of a jurisdictional conflict between the board. The boards have also adopted regulations setting forth advisory committee jurisdiction for closures, too. But again, we'd like to make that specific in the legislation just to try to clean up this matter so there's no confusion on it. And I think that's just about it as far as this legislation goes. I don't know if any of the members that are new here fully understand the relationship between the boards and the department and the advisory committees. If you don't, I'll be glad to explain it. But if you have any questions at all, try to answer me. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Are there any questions from the committee? Ms. Ellisman?
Just one small one. On Section C, when it says that the emergency closures are on the basis of advance approval,
mm-hmm.
How far in advance? I mean, can this just be a blanket approval in case an emergency comes up, or is there a possible problem with the board not meeting the time when an emergency might be needed?
Mr. Chairman? It would be possible to do it that way. The regulations that they've set up, if I remember correctly, now to cover this situation, require a notification of a certain number of members of the board and then a time for objection, I think, by the effective date of that regulation. I think that's the way it's done, but it is pretty fairly detailed procedure that the board set out to. It's not intended to be obstructionist at all, to make it impossible for them. So I think it could work in almost all cases.
Mr. Haynes?
Yes, sir.
Are you trying to take the power away from the advisory committees on this piece of legislation?
You mean take the power for emergency closures away?
No, for any proposals coming in. And
you mean just proposals for regulations and recommendations on the board? Absolutely not. It doesn't change anything in that respect. The only powers that we're affecting of advisory committees here have to do with this one issue of emergency closures. But as far as they're making recommendations to the board and testifying at board meetings and holding meetings and all that, it's all the same. In fact, the function of advisory committees has really been upgraded quite a bit in the last couple of years because of the adoption of bylaws and the establishment of a number of new committees. So it's been enhanced, but nothing in here would affect that, sir.
Well, on this emergency closures, I would like to see that left in for the advisory committees. At least you would get some action done between the department and the advisory committees. I closed it though as the chairman of the advisory committee in Sandpoint from the time we became a state till I got in the legislature here, just a couple of years before. And we had to close the district up there on account of the Fish and Game wanted to open it up for another month after they told us if we gave them a season till August 15th, where it all was closed August 10th. They said at the meetings that if we let them fish till the canneries, you know, till August 15th, they wouldn't ask for fall season, which we were against. In the meantime, they gave them another 30 days after August 15th, and the advisory committee, I was head of it, and we closed the season.
You actually closed it.
Very good. Policy for the advisory committees to have some power over it.
Mr. Chairman?
Closing. Yes.
Yes, sir. Yeah, this bill, even as it is worded here, would not prohibit an advisory committee from making a closure. But what we want to do is set it up so that it'll be, you know, it'll be an orderly procedure and that it'll be constitutional if it's done. I just, my own feeling is that it wouldn't be as it stands now. In fact, Representative Anderson asked for an opinion for the Department of Law last year on this issue, which we sent to him, and that was really what gave rise to this.
Is there any other questions? Mr. Haynes?
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any more to anybody else justify? What's the wishes of the committee?
I move to move it out of committee with a due pass recommendation.
Second.
You heard the question. Go out with a due pass. What? Yeah, all in favor Going out at a due pass, signify by raising your right hand. That's all of it.
I found $10 in my pocket.
There's no more to come before the committee, then. Meeting will be adjourned. Our first bill is House Bill 54, Administration of State Lands. Do we have anybody to testify? Ted Smith, do you care to testify on House Bill 54?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ted Smith. I'm the Director of the Division of Land and Water Management for the Department of Natural Resources. It's a pleasure for me to be here on the other end of the table for a change. The bill we have before us, 54, is an administration bill at the request of the Department of Natural Resources. And it's basically a cleanup bill that first takes care of, in Section 1, a problem we've had with land sales in the past, where the sale is in more than one recording district, or where it's close to the boundary of a recording district, and the center of population nearest is not within that recording district. What we're asking is to remove the requirement that the sale be held within the recording district where the sale is located in order to solve this problem. I have a map that shows the boundaries of existing recording district boundaries, which might help to clarify it somewhat. Note on the Kenai Peninsula, for instance, there's three separate recording districts, so that in terms of notification procedures, we're dealing with only one body located at Soldotna, the Borough Planning and Zoning Agency. But in order to conduct a sale that involved parcels of land, for instance, scattered throughout the peninsula, we may very well have to triple our administrative costs by holding a portion of that sale, one in each recording district. The bill is no attempt to avoid taking the business of the people to where the people are located, but it is an attempt to cut down the administrative overhead involved in doing that business. The remainder of the bill has to do with the question of negotiated sales of materials. Last year we amended the law to provide that 500,000 board feet of timber could be sold at negotiated sale. This changed it from a dollar limit, but we neglected the dollar limit on materials, gravel specifically. And this is a proposal that we change the present dollar limit of 5,000 to a 25,000 yard limit. And that's approximately equal dollar value. We're currently in place gravel on most of the sales is about 20 to 25 cents a yard. The last section, section 3 on the back, carries the same provision through to the requirement to notarize a sale. And we think that this is logical. If we can negotiate a sale, there's no need to go to the expense of having the purchaser and or the commissioner get their signatures notarized. We see it basically as a cleanup bill, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman, question. Mr. Malone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to ask Mr. Smith, how many of these negotiated sales take place during the course of, say, a year? I mean, roughly 10, 100, 1,000?
Material sales?
Yeah. For timber?
I don't have that figure. I would have to work from memory from about 10 years ago, and we used to have a substantial number. I don't know what the figure is today.
Is there any other questions, Mr. Smith?
One of the things, Mr. Chairman, in further response to Mr. Malone's question, we require that the purchaser pay the cost of advertising. In a non-negotiated sale, the law requires that it be advertised in the newspaper of general vicinity for 3 consecutive issues, and it's possible that that can come to a fairly expensive item, perhaps as much as he's paying for the material in some of the very small sales.
Mr. Urey?
Tim, in this first section here, when we remove that and within the recording district where it's currently located, I'm sure you guys wouldn't, but wouldn't it be possible at some time that there'd be a land sale in Sitka, for instance, and you could sell in Anchorage?
That's possible, Mr. Urey, and I don't think it's likely. The 3805305 has a fairly extensive notice requirement that the legislature last year enacted, which requires that prior to any disposal of land or interest in land, the cognizant governing body be notified. And I don't anticipate that it would be possible to notify the city and borough of Sitka of a sale there that would be held in Anchorage. Just from the standpoint of practical politics, I don't think that would ever happen. The fact is that you cannot dispose of any interest in land without notification in the area where the land is located. The subsequent sale will, in all likelihood, be very close, or at least as close as possible, to that specific location.
You don't think you have to say that by statute, to say that, although maybe not within the recording district, but maybe it should be as close as...
Well, I would certainly have no objection. The problem is trying to word it so that it conveys a sense of the legislature.
Are there any other questions, or Mr. Smith?
Chairman, I'll move the best bill out.
Is there anyone else to testify in this bill? Okay, you heard the motion to pass the bill out. Was that with a due pass?
Yeah.
How many due passes do we have to pass this bill out? Okay, it's a due pass. And the next bill we have on the calendar is House Bill 114, Fire Supreme Funds. Dane Welch, would you wish to? Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you.
Do you want to testify on this?
Uh-huh. Yes, I'm prepared to testify on this too, Mr. Chairman, if you'd like at this point.
Okay, we didn't have your name on the.
I'm perfectly happy to yield to Mr. Welch if you'd prefer that order.
No, that's fine, Mr. Smith.
Okay, thank you. As a result of some negotiations that were carried on some years back, and the further result of the bond issue that was passed at the 74 election, the state is moving to exercise its statutory responsibility for fire control and suppression on the Kenai Peninsula and in the Susitna Valley. The Kenai Peninsula was under state protection last year. This summer, a substantial portion of the Matanuska-Susitna Valley will be added to that. Now, in order to exercise those responsibilities, it's necessary to basically set up the fire department to start with. And this is what we call pre-suppression cost. We do this in two ways, by staffing these state facilities with state employees and providing for the hire of casual laborers in the event of a large fire. And we also provide it through contract with the Bureau of Land Management. The contract that we have with the Bureau of Land Management provides for annual estimate of pre-suppression costs and early payment of those, but it also provides for documentation of the cost of actual suppression of fires that occur on state or private lands. Ordinarily, we can predict with a fair amount of accuracy this cost of suppression. We do it on based on the five-year average of suppression costs and annually include that in our budget estimate. We include all of the estimated suppression, pre-suppression costs and the five-year average of suppression costs. But this leaves us in a good bit of trouble in the event we have a bad fire year. If we have an extra dry year, and we have lots of fire busts that we have to provide coverage on, the appropriated funds are not there to provide for payment to the private contractors and or casual employees that we man the fire with. Since this comes in the summer, it's ordinarily either just at the end of a fiscal year when you're out of money, or early in the fiscal year, which would exhaust your funds for the remainder of the year. The bill you have before you, 114, and its companion bill, 115, would establish a fire suppression fund and appropriate $750,000 to that fund. It's our expectation that this would be in effect an appropriation authorization, that we wouldn't spend the money until that particular year where the suppression costs exceeded our estimates and it was necessary to make payments to private contractors and employees that we'd called out on an emergency basis to man the fire lines. We are be required annually to report back to the legislature on the use of that fund, and we at that point would ask for an appropriation to get the fund back up to its $750,000 level. Mr. Miller, in discussion with us yesterday, indicated, I think very well, that it's a question of whether you do it now or do it later. We don't really have that much choice about obligating the funds. The question is whether we have the appropriation now or we're talking about a supplemental.
Is there any questions, Mr. Smith, from the committee?
Mr. Chairman, after our meeting yesterday, I got to thinking about it and I think I confused myself. In essence, we would have put the $750,000 aside right now, and that would be sort of a permanent $750,000. In addition to that, you would request through the budgetary process an additional amount equal to what you anticipate for this year. So the $750,000 would remain whole unless we exceeded the annual cost.
That's right.
Then that $750,000 will never have to be supplemented until the year comes when we have to go more than the annual off. Is that right?
When the year comes that it costs us $800,000 over the estimated amount for that year,
yeah,
then we'd be looking at supplementals.
Okay, fine. Then I did have it right, but I thought maybe I was getting my mixed up between the permanent $750,000 and the annual, whatever the amount is.
You've got it, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
And Mr. Miller.
Are any other questions of Mr. Smith from the committee? Hearing none, thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you.
We'll call on Mr. Welch.
10. I'm Dane Welch. I'm with the United States Forest Service here in Juneau, Alaska, and we work with the State Forestry Organization in the advancement of forestry and land management and fire prevention and suppression. And our organization supports the concept of having provision for the state to fund a firefighting force and provide for paying for people who are not on their employ of the state to suppress fires during these fire busts. Part of our organization does provide federal funds to assist the state. In the past few years, it's averaged around $400,000 a year, which has been going to encourage the state and provide this suppression activity and pay for the prevention and the other activities in fire prevention.
Is there any questions on the committee, or Mr. Lowe? Hearing none. Thank you, Mr. Lowe. What's the wishes of the committee? Mr. Bowen?
There's no further testimony.
Is there any more?
No. Mr. Chairman, I move and ask unanimous consent report out House Bill number 114 do pass.
You heard the question. How many do passes do we have? So ordered. Our next bill It's House Bill 115.
Mr. Chairman, since that's a companion bill, the funding bill to the one that we just passed, I'll make the same motion the Speaker made in relation to it. We didn't pass it out, we do pass it.
Any question?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Moore. Oh, never mind that.
It's a companion bill, and what's the wishes of the committee on House Bill 115? Okay. We got a due pass. All right. You pass it out, and how many due passes do we have? Okay, we got a due pass on that.
It's not really a hot issue, is it?
Is there any more to come before the committee?
Ed?
None. The committee is adjourned yesterday.